From last November through March of this year, 12 enrollees in my memoir class responded with grace and enthusiasm to my notion of what a memoir could be. I asked for much more than postcards from a life. I hoped for the specificity of a journal, a dash of poetry, if that suits, and certainly more than autobiography. I wanted an excavation of the heart, as well as memory, an engagement with one's choices. I got more than I asked for. Several participants wanted to record some essence of themselves for family. Most looked back modestly, even humbly, at what they judged to be their accomplishments. A few were survivors, ready to describe the struggle they'd been through. At least two had wider publication in mind, and others were curious, interested, hopeful. What we found was each other. We gave each other the opportunity to feel more and reveal more than we expected. We created a community that celebrated each other. This transformed into what you will hear this morning. You will receive the equivalent of a snapshot and a selective one. We can't right now show everything. We hope to hint at the range of experiences, good, ordinary, terrifying, terrible. I think of the task of writing the memoir as a religious journey, confronting the most essential questions of what it means to be fully alive, fully human, within the context of our culture, our circumstances, both shared and unique, in our limited time here. For our combined classes, the adventure continues. We will meet informally and enjoy having an audience, so watch for us again this summer. Today, you will hear from, in this order, Arlene Baldwin, Greg Duffy, Liz Ratcliffe, and Sue Stadler. And if you stay for second service, you get another set.
Thank you, Jeanette. My piece was based upon a challenge Jeanette gave us in the class. And the challenge was great advice you received but ignored. I went through that. I'd also subtitle it today, To Make a Change is a Challenge. The year was 1971. I was divorced, mother of three young boys, no child support, supporting myself and the kids on a small salary. I was working for the Idaho State Employees Association with a variety of duties, including secretary, investigator of employee complaints, board meetings, annual conventions for the association members, and that gopher girl for the director of the agency. At that time, the social and political activists across our nation were pushing for legislation for equal rights for women in a male-dominated workforce. My boss was well-educated, wise, had a sense of humor, a wonderful family, and on the private side of his life, he understood life through the eyes and words of his work as a part-time Episcopalian deacon at a Boise cathedral downtown. As part of our work for the Employees Association of the State of Idaho, he and I listened to legislative contacts and the State Department of Correction members, political contacts, who told us that because of a change in federal law, there would be some federal grant money to Idaho if Idaho would hire the first probation and parole officers for the state. Ditto for other states across the nation. Now, labor unions love that idea. My boss discussed the challenges facing women who would qualify and the challenges they might meet in the world of felons. They would see substance abuse, mental illness, liars, repeat offenders, and would be working often inside jails and penitentiaries. The officer could be or may be attacked or even sexually abused. Then he asked me if I would take the test, but underline these words, but only to make sure that the test would be given to women. It would be an assignment for me working for the State Employees Association, and he reassured me he did not want me to take the job. The goal was to keep the men in the correctional department responsive to the federal request to recruit and hire women. And yes, the lure of the grant money was big bucks for state departments across this whole nation, so they were all looking at that opportunity. And I don't want you to laugh at my qualifications when I went in to take the test, but my qualifications to be a parole officer were a bachelor's degree in education, and I had taught third and fifth grade. I had co-owned and worked in the Baldwin bookbindery. I had worked in a dental office, and as a student at the University of Wisconsin, had worked in the geology department. And I had sold women's wear in dress shops and worked as an investigator of complaints for the Employees Association and worked for a resolution to those problems, too. I also passed a background check because I did not have a prior criminal record, and there was an oral and written test. Today, I do not remember how many of us took the test. The result? I was offered a job in Lewiston, Idaho. On the board of directors for the Employees Association was a probation officer who encouraged me to take the job, telling me about the insurance benefits, the retirement benefits, the support I would receive from my fellow male officers, the badge I would carry, the courtroom experiences, the training I would receive from the Department of Corrections. He told me women in corrections were working in women's institutions as jailers or at front desks in clerical jobs, unknown to me at that time. What was really going on was the male POs, that means probation officer, wanted female officers to work with the female offenders because the female clients were driving the male officers nuts. And it seemed a good solution to the men to have female officers only work with female clients. I was hired July 1st, 1971. My first assignment was in Lewiston, Idaho, when I was trained by a very, very well-experienced supervisor. His name was Ernie. But as I traveled around and met the detectives and the local Lewiston police force, I noticed they were calling me a diaper dick. And in my mind, I won't even tell you what I was thinking, but I didn't know what that meant. So I asked Ernie to tell me what that meant because I was so green and so new. He said, "Ah, that's just a baby detective just learning the business." I was glad to hear that. Around 1973, in fact, I'm sure it was 73, I was transferred back to the Boise area and spent 22 years working in cases in Boise, Meridian, Cascade, McCall, and I grew in my professional life with experience and departmental training. I am very thankful that I became a PO, for it taught me to have respect for law and order, the court system and the parole system, and the complexity of the criminal mind. Two other women were hired at the same time, Mary and Barbara. Neither of them had any more qualifications than I did. But the three of us had long careers and loved the adventure, the responsibility, and the excitement of the work. And yes, we did wear pantsuits to court, and I do think that's because there were more female attorneys showing up working for the prosecutor's office and public defender's office, and they convinced the judge we could wear pantsuits. Qualified on the gun range, and then I frequently carried a caseload, like we all did, of 100 felons on any given day on our personal caseloads, and the men really did accept us on their team. And we assured correctional administration that we could carry caseloads of men and women offenders just as the male officers did. In the early 70s, the women's rights movement had its followers in Idaho, and I was one of them. I knew I could do this job if I had the training, which they assured me we received, and why not be one of the first women to be hired as a PO in the state of Idaho? I've never regretted the decision to take the challenging job, and have worked alongside some of the best judges, prosecutors, public defenders, correctional administrators, local law enforcement office, and I was a team, and I use that word team very loosely because we never fit on any organizational chart, but we had to know each other and we had to talk to each other, including social workers, vocational rehabilitation, other helping agencies in our community. We were all a team working on our challenge. I retired in 1995, and I worked for the department 1 year as a personal on a personal contract where I handled some special cases that had to be seen on a daily basis. I moved to Florida in 1997 and worked in, not corrections, didn't go to a halfway house. I worked in the fields of parks and recreation for the Village of Wellington and later promoted theater, music, and art for a cultural trust in Wellington. All of this happened because I ignored the advice of my former employer of the State Employees Association. Take the test, but don't take the job.
Yeah, my assignment was consequences. Some of this is even true. 1977. It was Tuesday morning. I was sick, but I still showed up by 9 o'clock. My boss, Steve, always gets there a little early. He'd already made coffee. Since he hired me a year ago, he'd been training me to be an assistant manager. He told me there was a great future for a guy like me if I worked hard. There was a lot of upward movement in the company at that time. He also told me he was glad that I drove stick shift because that would come in really handy for this job. As a loan officer for Thorpe Finance in Beloit, Wisconsin, I got the loan application from the customer, I got the credit report, and I showed it all to Steve for his approval. Robin, our secretary, would type up the loan papers, and I'd meet with the customers, and we'd sign the papers, and I'd give them the check so they could buy the car, they could spend more money on Christmas. Everyone would smile. That was the fun part. As time went on, I was the one who called them because they were late on their payments for their loan. I went to their homes when they stopped picking up the phone because they didn't want to talk to me. I hated my job, but I was good at what I did. Anyway, I was sick that morning, so I was having coffee with Steve. Steve told me the night before, I told Steve the night before I got a waitress's phone number. The truth was, it was a pretty waitress. She was at the Rocket Diner. But when I finally got up the courage to ask her for her phone number, she told me to leave her alone. So after dinner, I went to Tommy's Tavern right by my apartment. I spent the rest of the night feeling sorry for myself and drinking too much. So this morning, I wasn't sick. I was just very hungover. So I kept my distance from Steve because I know when I go out to Tommy's, my clothes always smell like smoke, and I'm sure my breath must be awful. By the time I'd finished my coffee, it was 9:30, and that's when Carl Mason walked in. Carl was seriously behind in his car loan. He was a man in his 30s. He was thin and muscular. He worked at the factory in town. He was wearing jeans and a yellow T-shirt with bold black letters on it. We went into the conference room. Carl explained that a month ago his wife had thrown him out. He had no address. He spent his nights in bars picking up women so he'd have a place to sleep. He was still working, but he wouldn't commit to making a payment on his car loan when he got paid on Friday. I looked at the black letters on his T-shirt. It read, "Slippery when wet." I stopped myself from chuckling, but I made a mental note to tell Steve about that later. Anyway, I was only half listening. One, because I was sick. And two, because I knew how this played out. In another couple of months, Steve would fall too far behind on his car payment. With no address, we'd publish his name in the paper with a court date. Carl would not show up to the court, so we would naturally get the judgment going to Thorpe Finance. Steve would give me the car title from Carl's auto loan, and I would take the title down to the dealership, who would make up keys based on the vehicle identification number. I'd spend Friday evening in the parking lot at the Piggly Wiggly, the only place in town you can get food and beer, so I knew Carl would be there on payday. Carl will go into the Piggly Wiggly. I'll take the keys out of my pocket. I'll drive away with the car because I drive stick shift, and Steve told me that this would be a very handy thing for this job. When Carl left the meeting, I wrote a quick letter, and I gave it to Robin to type. I got another cup of coffee. When the letter was ready, I showed it to Steve. And the letter said, "Dear Mr. Mason, please contact our office immediately to make arrangement to bring your auto loan up to date. Failure to do so will result in legal action. Sincerely, Greg Duffy, loan officer." I was going to sign it, put it in my jacket, and give it to Carl next time I saw him at the Piggly Wiggly. Steve looked at the letter at the desk, and he nodded his head with approval. I held out my hand to take the letter, but Steve opened his desk. He was looking for something. That's when I realized I was standing too close. Steve closed his desk drawer. He handed me the letter along with a breath mint and told me to go home.
We also had an assignment to describe a perfect day. So this is one of my days. My van is my very best thing. I've had her almost 6 years now, and she's driven almost 100,000 miles. Originally, she was christened Oyster. Then Webb said she should be called Scallop because scallops can move around in any direction. Then Brian said Scallop was too pedestrian, and so she should be called Coquille. Coquille, she is. Self-contained, elegant, sleeps four very friendly people, parks in my garage, reliable, she was built by Germans. She's almost perfect, and she hauls stuff, too. In my van, I awaken with the sunrise. The desert is coming alive and glowing. The air is cool, chilly even, so it's a relief to have my cozy place to have breakfast and listen to NPR on the satellite. Oh, yes, I'm here to watch the sage grouse gathering in an ancient lek to find a mate. Prump, prump, prump. Good luck, fellas. In the summer, I'm parked at my special spot on a small lake near McCall. Later, I will swim. And if no one is around, I'll take off my suit, being careful to keep it close by, and float on the surface where the sun has warmed the current. Lunch and a book, a walk around the lake to look for morels or huckleberries, depending on what's in season, a shot of Tullamore Dew, which is an Irish whiskey, and snacks in the late afternoon, another swim, and time to start supper. I always eat very well. It's more challenging because I'm a vegetarian and meat pulls a meal together more easily, but I manage. Sunset, maybe a small fire and a visit with the camp host. Then I read myself to sleep.
Good morning. I'm going to tell you a story about my dog, but first a note of explanation because her name's a little confusing to most. Her name is T-Bones. That's T-B-O-N-Z to make it sound really flashy. How she got her name is a whole other story, but just a hint, we got her at the Hagerman fossil beds. It was one of those sunny, warm days we often get in February in Idaho. After being cooped up all winter, it was time to get outside. My trusty hiking companion, T-Bones, jumped playfully in eager anticipation as I tied the laces on my boots. We both had had our daily dose of anti-inflammatory medications, so we were good to go. We drove to a trailhead not far from home with the intent of taking a short hike. I selected a trail that was new to me. It looked flat, just what we wanted. So off we went, with T-Bones racing ahead, stopping occasionally to make certain that I was keeping up. But flat the trail was not, not after you rounded that first bend. What was I thinking? After all, we were in the Boise foothills, emphasis on hills. And as it turned out, neither was it short. We kept walking, steadily gaining elevation, each time believing that the next ridge would be our last. But whenever we reached the top of one hill, we were presented with another, often steeper than the one we had just scaled. But I really did want to see the view from the top, wherever that was. I was becoming concerned, however, about T-Bones. She's a lively lab border collie mix with a white blaze on her chest and a tail that seems to be in perpetual motion. In years past, she's done a 12-mile hike. Just last year, she easily did 6 miles, but she is 14 years old. So trusting is this sidekick of mine that she will try to do anything I ask of her, never complaining, so I have to be cautious. How far can I push her? Have we gone too far already? She seems to be doing okay. Just a little further, and then we'll turn around. As we summited what I determined would be our final ridge, we were rewarded with a most spectacular sight. Spread out before us was the entire Boise front in all its snow-capped splendor. I could see Stack Rock on the far horizon. What a gorgeous day, and not another soul in sight. We lingered on the mountaintop for a while, soaking in the sunshine and the view. As we began our descent, I wondered how much longer my faithful dog would be able to accompany me on my adventures. I will certainly miss her when she can no longer do so. We have traveled a lot of miles together, but for this day, this wonderful day, it's just me and T-Bones.